Okay, so what we're doing this week that makes it especially interesting is we are kind of using everything that we've done up until now and saying, okay, so what about the kind of inquiry, the kind of investigation that that would really allow us to change our usual understanding? This is... Okay, that was Britta's answering machine. Okay, so...
Well, maybe call her. I don't know.
Oops, I just dropped her, too, and she... I think she just came on. I'm
she
sorry.
Did. She did just say, yeah, she did say, wait a minute, I'll be there. So...
I'll call her back.
Okay, call her back. But we'll keep going.
How did you say you could open up the camera?
How did you say? Were you asking how?
Yes.
Well, there's that little icon over on the top left that probably has a line through it that looks kind of like a TV screen and a telephone to me mixed together. But that's the
camera. Okay, you know what's so strange? I'm open up in the top left-hand corner, but there I am.
Okay, well, let's see. I'm...
I got you, Tina. You're on.
Okay, well, I don't see her yet, but we're not going to worry more about those details right now.
But she's on there. Down on that thing. Whoa.
Yeah. Okay.
It's delayed.
Okay. Anyway, so we're asking how we can actually put a different kind of knowing into operation. That's one way to say it. You know, we've been talking about all of these limitations on the way that the self knows, and as long as it's the self that's doing the knowing and the self that's taking the role of the bystander, we're going to be stuck with all of that. And at the beginning of this chapter, there's one more point that goes in that direction, and that is that if we rely on reason, which seems to be, you know, one of the few things around that we can rely on, in the sense that we say, well, if we couldn't rely on reason, you know, if I don't know that A plus B equals C, that's maybe not the best example, but if I don't know a few fundamental things like that, reason and logic and arithmetic, then I'm just lost. I can't know anything at all. So we may say, that's something reliable. But really at the beginning of this chapter, Rinpoche's saying, no, that's not going to work either. And it's not because he's saying that reason is wrong. He's just saying that reason goes along with everything else. Reason is based on descriptive knowledge. It's based on a certain understanding or story that we have. It's based on the bystander who steps back and reasons about whatever the bystander observes or encounters. All of those things are part of a whole package. And it won't get us anywhere in terms of trying to activate a different kind of knowing. So in this reading, and it's only the first part of the chapter for this time, in this reading, the question that's asked is... Or the question that we're going to ask anyway, is so what can we do? You know, how can we activate a different kind of inquiry? At the very bottom of page 269, Rinpoche says, as long as inquiry proceeds in terms of reasoning, it does not escape the structures of opposition. So, and so on. So, we want to escape the structures of opposition, and the question is, how could we do that? So there is actually in the first sentence of the chapter, there's yet another description of how the bystander's kind of knowing, that way of knowing, how that operates. And this description says, what the bystander knows is a world of surfaces and linear sequences. And then, you know, a mechanically understood progression. Okay. And I thought it would be helpful to really try to make that concrete. And the way that I'd like to make it concrete is by looking at the issue of emotionality. And that requires a little bit of background. I have to say a little bit about that, but I think it grows out of what we've already said. When we say, we don't know the world, or we don't know reality in all of its potential, we only know it in the way that the bystander can know. And so, of course, we really can't say, we know it, or I know it. But if we say, the kind of knowing that's available to us is the bystander's kind of knowing, the natural tendency is to think in terms of a world that we can know, or a reality that we can know. And that's fine as far as it goes, but there's no reason that we can't know the other elements of our experience in this different way as well. And the particular other element that I thought it would be good to focus on is this question of emotionality. So in our ordinary way of understanding, emotions and our kind of subjective reactions to situations are secondary. First, there's an experience or a situation, and then we react to it. We like it or we don't like it. We get upset. We get interested. We get excited. We get bored. And that's all on the level of a kind of a secondary reaction, and really isn't where knowing operates at all. It's the subjective realm. There isn't anything to know, although, as we'll see in a moment, that's not a very accurate way of saying it. But what I'm suggesting is that we really can apply this same notion of a different way of knowing to our emotions. And the place I want to start with that is what we were talking about last week in terms of positioning, right? So as soon as you think of it that way, I think it's easy to see that there's a link with emotions. So the bystander takes a position, or the self. It's really better for now, I think, to say the self takes a position. And the self is conditioned. We talked about that last week. So the position and the condition that we find ourselves in is always, maybe always is too strong, but it is, I'm going to say it for now, it is always also an emotional condition. We wake up in the morning and we're feeling a certain way. We're feeling good. Maybe we're feeling rested, which doesn't sound exactly like an emotion, but it goes in that direction. Maybe we're feeling worried. Maybe after we've been awake for 5 minutes, we suddenly remember something that we have to take care of. And then we have, a kind of an emotional response to that. But the point that I'm really trying to make is that in every situation that we find ourselves in, it's not as though we're just a video camera, working in the five senses, more complicated than a video camera, but it's not as though we're just a camera registering what's going on in the world. The world is a feelingful place. It's our reactions, our engagement, our lack of engagement, our liking and disliking, those are all just as much a part of the position that we take as the self, as what we see around us. So, I'm looking at my computer screen right now, and some of the rest of you are also. And if you look a little deeper, maybe you're very used to your computer and you haven't thought about it much. But just looking at your computer, there is a reaction to it. There is an engagement with it, a certain kind of engagement with it. you know, there's this sense that you've developed as kind of an old computer and you'd like to get rid of it and get a new one, or there's a sense that it's a new one and you're excited about it, or there's a little bit of a history of some problem you had with it recently. You know, all of that is there, and that's the conditioning and the positioning. So, yes, you recognize it as a computer, and you know how to use it, more or less, but you also have this kind of emotional reaction, which is not something that comes second. It's built in from the very beginning. That's really the point that I'm trying to make. And that emotional reaction, that position, which is our emotional reaction, is, you know, you could say it's an attitude or a mood or a sense of the way things are. Or it may actually be a more specific kind of charged emotion. Maybe not so much with our computer, unless you've just had unless you've just gotten really angry at your computer, which happens sometimes too. But if not computers, people, you know, or if not people, your job, or you know, a whole range of things. So it may not be a really intense emotion, but there is this level of emotionality, and that's what I'm trying to look at in terms of positions. So the question is, and this is where we want to be looking, is can we be involved, be engaged in the position, which in this case is the emotion, and at the same time inquire into it. So we're not trying to change the emotion. We're not trying to transform it into something more positive if it's negative. We're not trying to separate ourselves from it. And you know, take a more detached view, although in a sense, you know, it may go in that direction. No, what we're trying to do is just be within the emotional dimension of our situation, and not try to change it, but simply inquire into it, right? And that's the question. And so the issue is now, what can we do about it? I mean, that's kind of the challenge. And the issue is, what do we do about it? Right? So there's a very good guide, a very good suggestion about that, which I referred to in the orientation. It's in the second full paragraph on page 270. And Rinpoche starts off by talking about reason. He says, in the same way, he's talking about surfaces and limited perspectives and how we can go beyond that. And actually, I guess I should go to the paragraph above that, because he says we can inquire into what's going on. And there he's talking about observation. We can inquire into observation as it operates. And I'm suggesting that instead of focusing on operation, it tends to be more meaningful for us to inquire into the emotion or tone or attitude we have in a situation. You can say the same thing. We can inquire into it as it operates. And then he says, in this chapter, in this paragraph I was just pointing to, he says, reason can be investigated in ways that do not depend on reason, and the operation of cause and effect can be open to inquiry without placing that inquiry within a causal sequence. Now, this is, we have to explore what this actually means. And Lois gives an example in the chat section here about breathing and looking at the breath. And it is very much like that, yes. But, you know, so if you think about it in terms of the breath, it's not so much, it's not looking at the breath from outside. It's breathing and inquiring into the breathing in the act of breathing, in the operation of the act of breathing. It's a knowing that happens within the breathing, not a knowing that looks at the breathing. So Maybe that's helpful to think of that example. So he says, to go on with that paragraph, we can look at the patterns of intentional knowledge without first accepting the confines of conventional intentionality, and can investigate desire without being caught up in its flow. So those last two examples take us more in the direction of the emotions, and that's in a way what I'm relying on here in taking this approach, right? Maybe desire is an example of an emotion. So you'd say, we don't try to change the desire. We experience the desire, and we're aware of the experiencing of the desire, or probably a better way to say it is, we're aware of the desiring. Or we desire knowing that we're desiring. So that's similar to a lot of instructions that you get in meditation traditions. Right? We're doing it with a specific aim in mind. What we're trying to do is not hold on to our position, but activate knowing, a different kind of knowing, by inquiring into our position. So if I'm feeling, it's always arbitrary which example I select because everybody's different. If I'm feeling agitated, if there's a sense of agitation, I experience the agitation. Right? I'm aware of, and of is, creates too much distance, the word of, but we have our language. So I'm aware of the agitation, or I'm simply agitated, but in a way that I know what's going on. And really the distinction that's made, I think, is that if we accept the agitation as our position, we say, I'm agitated. Sometimes if you're having a conversation, this is considered to be pretty sophisticated in the sense, to be able to identify your experience, and you say to someone else, and you say, that makes me angry. What you just said makes me angry. Or, I don't feel appreciated, or that kind of thing that gets said, okay? What you're doing is taking a position. And you're acknowledging the position, and that's a lot better than not acknowledging the position. But you are absolutely taking the position. You're owning the position. You're insisting on the position. You're claiming the position. You're setting yourself up in the position. And that's all in terms of positions. If we look at it for a moment in terms of conditioning, what happens is you find yourself looking at cause and effect. You say, well, I'm angry at what you just said. That's a conditioning kind of a statement, right? Because you said this, it makes me angry, right? That's another way of looking at what's going on. So we own the position, we trace out the conditions that led to the position. That's what we're always doing. That's what the bystander does. And I said before that the bystander, it's better maybe to talk about the self initially, because bystander sounds like completely neutral, right? Like an innocent bystander. It's the way we talk about that in English. Not involved in what's going on. But in a sense, that's right. But it's also true that the bystander is observing, and part of what's being observed is emotionality. That's part of the position. So that's why it's probably a little easier to talk about the self. And if we say, that's what I'm feeling, that's what I'm experiencing, that's what my position is. And the suggestion here, the point here, is that the inquiry that we're doing depends on not taking the position or not accepting the conditioning. It means not relying on cause and effect. So if you're feeling, if you're having a conversation, someone says something, and as a result, and that's how we say it, and it makes sense to say it that way, because of what they've said, it makes you angry, right? But in fact, in the moment of feeling angry, there's simply the experience of being angry. And the story that supports it, the condition, the cause and effect sequence, I'm angry because you said this to me, that's also something to experience or something to be aware of. So, Lois, you're saying it's multiplying our understanding of our experience. If that's a helpful way for you to think about it, I think that's fine. We're opening up the experience in a way that doesn't make it our position. Right? And
we're not seeing it as our identity.
We're not identifying with it. We're not seeing it as our identity. That's right. That's right. And when that happens, of course, it changes things. But it may only change them in a very subtle way. Take the example of desire. And I was thinking about this yesterday because I knew we'd be talking about this in class. So at a certain point during the day yesterday, I thought at the end of the day, instead of really having a real dinner, I'm going to treat myself and go over to this store just a couple, very close to where I work, and have a milkshake. That'll be my dinner. And that was kind of an interesting example to work with because all day long, not that I was thinking about it all the time, but, when I thought about it, I thought, oh, yeah, well, that's what I'm going to be doing at the end of the day, and there's a certain anticipation that goes with it. That was a positioning, right? That was, I was sort of setting things up. That's what was going to happen. That particular position was about what I was going to do. Now, all day long, whenever that came up, there was a certain quality of awareness, and it was fairly subtle, but there was a certain quality of awareness, and Lois said she had the same experience with a cookie, right? food is, for some people it doesn't matter, but for a lot of people food is a great object to work with because it plays a certain role in our emotional life, our emotional landscape. So whenever that came up, I was aware of myself taking that particular position. Now, did I therefore decide not to go along with that position or not to identify with it? Well, not exactly. I mean, I went and had the milkshake. I could have done it differently. And the fact that I decided to do it, does that mean that I was just kind of very, in a very inquiry-centered way, was looking at what it was like first to have the desire, then to make the plan, then to go ahead and act on the plan, or was I just doing it because I wanted to do it? It's a fairly subtle distinction. And I wouldn't even say, which one was right, except I will say that it made me very sensitive to what was going on when I was actually having the milkshake. I didn't actually like it as much as I expected I would, for whatever that's worth. the subtleness of that distinction, I think, is one of the reasons that people have a hard time sometimes with TSK. If we ask people, well, so what's the benefit? Why do you study TSK? What do you get out of it? What kind of changes do you notice? I think in some circumstances that becomes relatively clear, and in some circumstances it's not particularly clear. Either way, I think it's a fairly subtle thing. But if you adopt that position, or, see, now that's a very wrong way to say it, if if you commit yourself to a kind of inquiry into what's going on, then over time, that is going to shift everything. And it may only shift it, you know, by one degree. it's not as though you're necessarily a different person now, but you are ready to question your positions and the conditioning in a way that you weren't otherwise. And that in itself leads to the question, to the experience, let's say, of freedom. By the way, and it may be relevant, I looked up the word free the other day in an etymological dictionary. It's actually related to the word friend. It has to do with taking a kind of a friendly position. A free man was a friend. That's where it came from, pretty much. The reason that might be relevant is that you're being kind of friendly with your positions, but you're not going along with them. You're not buying into them. And so if you look again at that question, why is it that it's difficult to describe the effect or the impact or the value of TSK inquiry? Another way of saying that is that asking the question, you say, well, what's the benefit of TSK? That already asks you to take a position, right? You have to kind of step outside and say, well, because I practice TSK, such and such happens, right? Now, you may want to do that. You know, we tell each other stories. We give each other explanations all the time. And there's nothing wrong with that. But it does kind of go against the grain here. The point of the inquiry is a kind of an understanding that comes from dwelling within. It's an inquiry that's not separate from our way of being. So, let's take an example that is closer maybe to what people like to work with sometimes. Let's say you're feeling depressed. You know, not clinically depressed, you're just kind of, nothing really seems very worthwhile to you. You know? And so you say, what can I do about this? How can I change my feeling, my situation? In the terms we're talking about now, we say, well, that's my position. And I don't like that position, so how can I switch? How can I take another position? Well, of course, that's not a very fruitful way to think about it from a TSK perspective. For two reasons. First of all, taking another position does not really help, right? I mean, it may change your mood. If you can jump from one position to another, and the fact that you can jump from one position to another, that may be very interesting. You know, that may be really worth exploring. Why it's possible, how it's possible to do that. But the actual fact that, you know, a moment ago you had this position and now you have another position, that doesn't tell you anything very interesting in terms of inquiry. So that's one reason that it's not so helpful to look at it that way. The second reason, of course, is that it, again, it takes you into this cause and effect sequence, right? Something is causing me to feel depressed. So what do I do to change my mood? Do I have to change, you know, sort of find some different causal pattern to enter into? Well, again, that won't work too much or help too much with this kind of inquiry. So what do you do in this kind of inquiry if you're feeling depressed? Well, you engage, and, you know, we don't have the right verbs. You engage the depression. You engage the feeling. You inhabit the feeling. You let yourself experience it fully. You don't identify it with it as your position. Right? So, when we have a particular emotion, and we've been, you know, I've spent the whole session today talking about emotions because it seems to me it's helpful. I mean, it's something that people are concerned with, you know, how they're feeling. It's kind of a big deal for human beings, you know. Am I happy or not happy? Am I depressed? Am I joyful? We care a lot about that. So that's why I've been focusing on it. When we make that our position, we say, I'm happy, I'm angry, I'm agitated, whatever it is. We're labeling our experience, we're taking a position. The alternative that's being discussed here, that's being operated here, being suggested here, is that we can, and again, I just don't have exactly the right verb. We engage, we inhabit, maybe the best word, it's the one that Rinpoche uses in pretty much in this context, is we know what we're feeling. We don't try to change it. We don't know it from outside. We don't know it because we've applied a label. You know, we don't say, oh, now I know what I'm feeling. I'm feeling depressed. You know, that can be helpful sometimes. It helps crystallize something. But the kind of knowing we're talking about here is not taking or relying on that kind of a label or taking that kind of a position. It means that within the situation we're in, we just inhabit it fully. And I come back to that word inhabit because I find it helpful. It's not a word that Rinpoche particularly uses, although I think he does occasionally. But I find it helpful. We inhabit our position fully, which means we don't treat it as a position. Because treating it as a position means exactly that we don't inhabit it fully. We apply the label, we say, this is my position, and then we can kind of ignore it. Or ignore isn't the right word, but, you know, then we're no longer, how can we say that? We're conditioned by it. And we've lost the opportunity to really respond with a kind of an inner freedom. And what gives us that freedom, what lets us take freedom or recover freedom from the positions that we occupy is to reject that sense of being conditioned by the way things are. And it's a kind of a paradox here, but it's not, in practice, it's not really a paradox. It's the paradox, let me say it as a paradox, is that the way that we free ourselves from whatever positions we take is by accepting them completely, is by engaging them completely. And the way out of the paradox, which I've already suggested, is that we do that by not treating them as positions. Now, you can fool yourself, because you can say, oh, I mean, it's like with the milkshake, right? They say, oh, I wasn't accepting, you know, I wasn't letting myself be conditioned by this desire for a milkshake that I had set up and then decided to act on. I was just knowing what was going on. I was involved in what was going on. I was inhabiting the structure that I'd created for myself. And saying that to myself, you know, is a good way of just doing whatever I feel like doing in that particular moment. So you need to be able to trust yourself. You need to be able to trust your commitment to knowing, really. Because if it's just a question of kind of putting a little sophisticated spin, a sophisticated added label onto your position, your desire, your emotion, your reaction, whatever it is, that's not going to help at all. But if you're committed to really engaging what's going on at a level deeper than that surface level of the label, the position, the condition, then there's an opportunity for change. And again, it's a subtle difference, which is one of the reasons it's hard to say, this is what TSK does for me. You know, even if there's an answer to that question, the answer has to do with a you know, with inhabiting fully, and the moment you turn around to describe what it means to do that, then now you're back into the realm of labeling and telling stories. So, hard to talk about the difference, but perhaps possible to experience it. Okay, so let me just ask, I mean, I did a lot of talking here, and we had a couple of comments. Anybody want to say anything about that? No? Well, I'm going to assume that's because there's food for thought there, and you can go away and work with it. And there is something very lovely about this way of working, because you're not rejecting anything. That's kind of the positive side of this. You're not rejecting your situation. In fact, you're accepting it as fully as you can. And that's, and doing that is what's called inquiry. So we didn't talk about something I'd said we would talk about, which was your experience with exercise 5, disowning tension. And it might be interesting to think about how that exercise relates to what we were talking about today. But I'll try to make a point of talking about it next week. So for next week, we will finish up the chapter. And the themes naturally are going to be very similar. So we'll have a chance to return to this. But if you can, during the week, see if you can investigate this or go back over the chapter in light of some of the things I was trying to point out today and see if it gives you a kind of a way of engaging your experience that that goes in this direction of a kind of inhabiting, embodying, complete mode of being and inquiry. Because in the end, and that's another way of saying this, being your own self, being your own situation, and inquiring into it are not two separate things. Okay, well, let's stop there for today, and we'll meet again next Sunday.